If I utter the name Titanic, you'll probably have certain images that come to mind. Now, I wasn't there as an eyewitness to the sinking of the Titanic, but I've seen the movie 3 times, and maybe you have too. And of course, the whole occasion, the tragedy that it was highlighted here recently in recent years by the very successful movie. I guess success, at least in the sense that it, you know, a lot of people saw it, made a lot of money and all. But as you recall the story, the Titanic was touted as one of the greatest things to ever hit the oceans, a great feat and wonder of human ingenuity and genius. And they even went so far as to say that it couldn't be sunk. And if you'll remember the story, at least from the movie, again, not having been there, they were a little bit complacent as they set off, headed for New York from the British Isles. And the fellows in the crow's nest up there that were supposed to be looking for icebergs, at least the way the movie told it, they didn't even have binoculars. And there was the one scene you recall where the discussion of how many lifeboats there were came up. And it didn't appear, I believe it was Rose that was in the conversation with the chief engineer, it didn't seem to her that there were enough lifeboats for everybody on the ship. And the engineer explained to her, well, that's right, there's only about a third enough. Because, you know, it cluttered the deck and they didn't want so much clutter on the deck. And besides that, the ship won't sink, so what do we need lifeboats for anyway? And so you remember the story. It wasn't long out to sea. They hit an iceberg and the mighty Titanic sank. And it was a horrible tragedy. William Barclay describes one incident in the aftermath of the sinking of the Titanic that I think is interesting. It helps to illustrate the point that I want to make today. In A Night to be Remembered, Walter Lord tells in detail the story of the sinking of the Titanic in April 1912. There was an appalling loss of life when that new and supposedly unsinkable liner hit an iceberg in the middle of the Atlantic. And after the tragedy had been announced, the New York newspaper, The American, devoted a leader to it, some special insert, I suppose, dealing with the whole affair. The leader was devoted entirely to the death of John Jacob Astor, the millionaire. And at the end of it, almost casually, it was mentioned that also 1,800 others lost their lives. And so those 1,800, however, were not newsworthy. John Jacob Astor, the richest man probably in America at the time, or very one of them certainly, he went down and was lost. That was newsworthy. The only man who really mattered, the only one with real news value, was the millionaire. The other 1,800 were of no real importance. You know, most unfortunately, it happens that way in our human culture a great deal. We tend to stratify things. There is the first class, and of course the movie Titanic did a very good job of illustrating. There's the first class passengers, and there's the second class passengers, and there's the steerage down there in the depths of the ship, in the bowels of the ship, where we put the Irish and such, you know, and other untouchables, you see. And oftentimes that's the way it is. And, you know, it's not that way with God. God sees every one of us alike, is aware of all of us, and he doesn't forget nor lose any of us. And that is well illustrated. If you'll turn to Mark chapter 6 now, we'll spend most of our time here illustrating the point that God doesn't forget anyone. I've entitled the sermon, All Heaven's Power for One. And here's a good example. Mark and Matthew both give this example and speak of it. I'll start in Mark's account, Mark chapter 5 and verse 21. I have the New International Version here this afternoon. And this section of the fifth chapter of Mark is titled A Dead Girl and a Sick Woman. And so we pick up the story. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Now, in Matthew's account, which occurs in chapter 9, it says that he went to his own town. And, of course, we know he was born in Bethlehem, raised in Nazareth. But by the time he began his ministry, and like as not, his own town would have been Capernaum, where Peter had lived, and where they had a place where they would gather from time to time when he was in that part of the area. Much of his ministry was in Galilee. They would be there. And if you remember the way Jesus' ministry began, as Luke describes the situation in chapter 4, he stood up to read. He read from the book of Isaiah. And he told them, in reading those verses, that this day, this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. And if you'll recall the response, they were not too happy with it. Fact is, they gathered him up and tried to throw him over the hill and dispose of him. So he's back in his own home area once again. And he has this incident, a large crowd. Now it's interesting. Try to picture the situation. What is a large crowd? Dozens? Scores? Hundreds? Thousands? In the next chapter, he's going to feed 5,000 men, plus women and children. So it could be thousands. His fame is spreading throughout the region. He's performing miracles and doing marvelous things. And crowds, hordes of poor, suffering human beings follow him in the hope of receiving some favor, some measure of grace, if you will. And so a large crowd followed and pressed around him. In verse 25, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. Now, think about this. Here's a woman who has suffered with a particular ailment, a bloody issue, for 12 years. Now, reading from Barclay, he has an interesting take on it. I think it's useful to interject here to help us understand what this meant for this woman. From the Jewish point of view, this woman could not have suffered from a more terrible or humiliating disease than an issue of blood. It was a terrible thing, which was very common in Palestine. The Talmud sets out no fewer than 11 different cures for it. Some of them were tonics and astringents, which may well have been effective. Others were merely superstitious remedies. One was to carry the ashes of an ostrich egg in a linen bag in the summer and in a cotton bag in the winter. Where would you get an ostrich egg to begin with? I don't know what you would have to do or and why they came up with this. I can't believe that any issue of blood was ever, dried up or assuaged by packing around, the ashes of an ostrich egg. Might be good in the compost pile. Now, another one was to carry about a barley corn which had been found in the dung of a white she-ass. Now, think of that. Not all she-asses are white, I presume. So you find the white one, barley corn, it's fed to the animal, passes through undigested into the dung, and so you scrape through the dung trying to find the barley corn and pack it around with the hope that, you'll be healed. So when Mark tells the story, he makes it clear that this woman had tried everything and had gone to every available resource, and her condition was only worse. So notice, she had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. Now again, you want to understand what it means in the time to have a bloody issue. There were issues of clean and unclean, of ritual purity and impurity. And to have a issue of blood or to come in contact with inappropriate things or in difficult circumstances, you got to realize you would have troublesome circumstances. Leviticus has a lot to say about clean and unclean and pure and impure. And here's what she was faced with. This is Leviticus 15, verse 25. When a woman has a discharge of blood for many days at a time, other than her monthly period, or has a discharge that continues beyond her period, she will be unclean as long as she has the discharge. Just as in the days of her period, her bed that she lies on while her discharge continues will be unclean, as is her bed during the monthly period, and anything she sits on will be unclean, as during her period. Whoever touches them will be unclean. He must wash his clothes and bathe with water. He will be unclean till evening. Now think of this. This woman has a continuous or regular issue of blood for 12 years. She is continually unclean for 12 solid years. She can't come in contact with anybody. So now just think about it. Here she is in a desperate strait, and it says in the account, again by Mark, verse 27, the situation has grown worse, not better. She's desperate. She heard about Jesus. She came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. If I can just get that close. Now think what this woman has to go through in order to get close to Jesus. It's a large crowd, maybe hundreds or maybe even thousands. She's got to be more than just a little assertive to get anywhere near. And I suspect she has to come incognito. Perhaps she's robed, maybe her face is covered, so she's not recognized. Oh, that's that unclean woman who for 12 years has been unclean. You can imagine the desperate straits that she is in. And so she's putting herself in a good deal of jeopardy to even be found in the crowd. Because when you're unclean, ritually unclean, impure, you know, you have to be apart from the group for a time and fulfill the necessary obligations to return to a state of purity once again. But this woman is desperate. And so she thinks to herself, you know, she's not being presumptuous. I won't bother the master with some big sad story. I'll just get close enough. If I can just get close enough to touch him, that's all it will take. She's heard the stories, remarkable ones, about what Jesus has done for others, the grace that has been extended. And so she has hope. And she musters up the last bit of her courage and sets out to get close enough to touch the master. So she thought, well, I'll just get close enough, I'll touch him, I'll be healed, it'll be in a crowd, I can just melt back into the crowd and disappear, won't make a fuss, nobody will know, and it'll be fine. Well, okay. So, indeed, she did get close enough, and she did reach out and touch his garment. And notice verse 29. Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. And at once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" It's a big crowd. They're pressed about him. She touches his clothes, manages to squeeze through between who knows who, what individuals and what circumstances to reach out and touch him. The crowd is pressing around. She knows immediately something special has happened. And by like fashion, Jesus knows immediately too. And no doubt Jesus' response to her act seeking healing was totally unexpected. She didn't expect Jesus to whirl around and look and say, "Who did that? Who touched me?" And so she froze. She couldn't leave. She didn't know what to do. Notice what it says. Verse 30. Well, Jesus asked in verse 30, "Who touched my clothes?" And in verse 31, "You see the people crowding against you," his disciple answered, "and yet you can ask, 'Who touched me?' You must be kidding. Are you joking? There's a mob here. What do you mean? Everybody's banging against you and rubbing against you and shoving you along to the next spot. How can you ask, 'Who touched me?'" But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Now, it wasn't evidently just a casual attempt to find out who'd done it. He wanted to know who did it. And so you can imagine the impact that it had on this poor woman. All she wanted to do was touch him, disappear back into the crowd, and be gone. No fuss, no muss, don't bother anybody. But it wasn't to be that way. Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Maybe he started wading through the crowd, sifting through people, trying to figure it out. He wanted to know what is going on here. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, I mean, she couldn't escape, and how was she going to escape through the crowd anyway? But knowing what had happened, that is, she had been healed. And indeed, you know, it had come to pass. She came and fell at his feet, and trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. What do you expect she was expecting from Jesus? Here's a woman who's been unclean for 12 years. She's had the unmitigated gall to plow into the middle of a crowd, making everyone she touched unclean. What do you think that she thought Jesus might do? You think she might have expected to get a sermon, to be excoriated and spited? She'd been healed, she knows that. But it didn't turn out quite the way she expected. And now she's trembling before the Master in fear. And she tells the entire story. So, Jesus said to her, and again, you might expect that at this point she would get a sermon about the inappropriate behavior and how this is a whole wrong way of going about this sort of thing, and so on and so forth. So, to call upon the first message, and here is an example of grace being extended, without a doubt. He says, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." No sermon. You know, Perry made reference to the fact that in days gone by, we emphasized a good deal about the necessity for keeping and obeying the commandments, and perhaps a little oversight in the area of grace. We were very good at cause and effect, right? For every effect, there was a cause. There's no curse, you know, without a cause. And so, must have been something going on here. But Jesus didn't lecture her. He didn't give her a sermon. He didn't say and point out all of her inappropriate behavior and what she was doing and how it was wrong and inappropriate and so on and so forth. No, he didn't do anything like that. Now, we all know, don't we, that we have done things that are totally inappropriate, that we've brought problems upon ourselves because of our stupidity, because of our inability to just follow the lead of God's Spirit. I think we can all say that. If you can't yet, you believe me, you will. You will. And this is a part of grace. Grace is extended to who? To people who don't deserve it. If you deserve grace, you're not going to get it because you don't need it. You need grace. We all do. And Jesus here extended it to her. Now, you've been in those situations where you've done something silly. You know, when a child spills the milk at the dinner table, oh my, it can be bad news. Now, when mom or dad spills the milk, silence, man. Quiet. You've done silly things. A little incident occurred, the kind of thing you'd yell at your kid for. When we were on the farm, I had this place where I parked my pickup. And it was tight in good weather, you know. I mean, just right. If you paid attention to what you were doing, in and out, no problem. Well, it's just January, and it's icy. The snow out in front faces the north, so it never thaws. You drive over the snow a few times, it turns to ice. So you're in there, and you're going to back out, and you know, well, I got to be careful now. This is a tight fit, you know, in good weather. And now there's an icy entrance here. All right, you start up, put it in reverse and back out, and sure enough, it's slippery, and the rig slides to the right, hits the wall, and knocks the right mirror right off of there. That'll be $204, please. It's the kind of thing you'd yell at your kid about. You stupid kid, don't you know that's a tight fit even in good weather? All the more reason, you know, to be careful in bad weather. But when dad or mom do it, it's a different proposition. But what are you going to do? You see, most of us as adults, and let's give ourselves a little credit, you know, God has called us out of this world, and we've given ourselves to Him, and we're doing the best we know how to follow God's way. Most of the time when we get ourselves into a troublesome circumstance, we don't really need a sermon. We know what we did that got us into trouble. There's the shattered mirror and who was driving. I mean, you know. So, but now you might ask yourself a question here. This is how Jesus dealt with this woman. Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace, be freed from your suffering. No word or reference to uncleanness or inappropriate behavior or whatnot. She was just very thankful. And we have no indication that she was guilty of anything inappropriate anyway, other than, you know, having been presumptuous enough to wade into a crowd in an unclean condition. Now, it's a good lesson here on how to treat one another. We have occasions to, you know, to be with one another, to fellowship with one another. We have occasions when we'll encounter one another when we're in troubled circumstances. And oftentimes, what we need is grace extended. We need to be welcome, all of us. When we come together, we need to feel free, knowing that we are welcome, that we are being received and treated with graciousness. And so it's a great example. So Jesus kept looking around till he'd find who had done it. The woman, trembling in fear, told the whole story. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. So it's amazing, the whole situation. And so we have an example of a woman who needed help, and Jesus Christ extended the help. So it's a great example for all of us. And so we accept the fact that we sometimes come a little short. I mean, if you haven't come up short a time or two and received the grace of God, I mean, it is important that we do that. Have you ever had an occasion, as this woman did, when it seemed as though everything stopped and the attention was on you? Now, when it happened to her, she no doubt had mixed feelings because she knew she had been healed. You're bleeding one instant and the next you're not. I presume that that's very obvious, that the effect is real and it was immediate. Wonderful thing. And so, Jesus turns and all attention is on her. Barclay has an interesting insight at this point as well. The subject is all heaven's power for one. And I think we can all expect that all heaven's power will be directed to us in our time of need. That's what this little story is about. It's not about the important person, the leader of the synagogue. We'll deal with him a little bit here too. When she touched it, that is, when she touched the robe, Jesus' garment, it was as if time stood still. It was as if she were looking at a motion picture and suddenly the picture stopped and left us looking at one scene. The extraordinary and the unmoving, beautiful thing about this scene is that all at once, amidst that crowd, Jesus halted, stopped everything he was doing, stopped his lecture or stopped receiving questions or whatever it was he was engaged in this little journey. And for a moment, it seemed that for him, no one but that woman had nothing but her need existed. So suddenly his attention was on this one woman. She was not simply a poor woman lost in the crowd. She was someone to whom Jesus gave the whole of himself. She had his full attention. Now, I take courage, encouragement from this example because you and I can expect to have full attention from Jesus Christ in our time of need. Now, there's some hard questions that come up here. You know, why did it take 12 years? Where was Jesus during year number 11 or year 10 or year 9 or year 8, for as far as that goes? I don't know the answer to that. You may be in year 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 or whatever of a particular trial or a circumstance for which you're looking for an answer and don't have it yet. You aren't lost in the crowd. You aren't just one of the mob that went down with the Titanic and John Jacob Astor gets all the attention. God has called each and every one of us and has extended grace to us, And when God extends grace to us and begins to work with us and to deal with us, He does. He doesn't just ignore us then and sort of send us on our way to do the best we can. He's with us the whole time. All right. So let's go back again now to Mark 6 and notice a little further. Now while Jesus was still speaking, some came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler, "Your daughter is dead." Now, what we have as this incident begins, verse 21, Jesus had again crossed over the boat to the other side of the lake. A large crowd gathered around him while he was at the lake. Then one of the synagogue rulers, now this is a synagogue ruler, right, in the area where Jesus was from. It is entirely possible this guy Jairus was in the synagogue when Jesus opened the scroll of Isaiah and read the verses and said, "Today is this, are these verses fulfilled in your hearing?" And he might have, I don't know, he might have been involved in running him over the hill. He was this carpenter's son that thinks he can stand up and claim that the scriptures are speaking of him. But again, it's an act of, now this, so let's just assume that maybe this was the case. Jesus may know this man personally. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. So you see, they were on their way to Jairus' house where his daughter was dying. Jairus was the synagogue ruler, the leader of the synagogue, the John Jacob Astor of the situation, if you will. Okay? And en route, this poor unclean woman throws herself at Jesus' mercy, and he extends grace to her. But it's interesting. How did he treat Jairus, who may have been involved in trying to throw him over the hill? You can read about it in Luke chapter 4 and dispose of him early on. So Jesus, while Jesus was still speaking, now we're in verse 35. Some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" All right, there's no point in going on with this. Ignoring what they said, Jesus said to told the synagogue ruler, "Don't be afraid, just believe." Now again, I've speculated a little bit as to what Jairus' situation may have been relative to Jesus and the true gospel and so forth. But Jesus didn't offer a sermon to him either. He says, "You know, fella, I don't know you a thing." And, you know, you can imagine what could have been said. If Jesus were of the mind and sort to make us pay the uttermost farthing. But he never does that. If he asked us to pay the uttermost farthing, what chance would any of us have? We'd be doomed. Totally and completely doomed. And so, again, noting that my speculation relative to the position between Jairus and Jesus might be suspect, nevertheless, how Jesus responded was not suspect. If there was something in the past there that Jesus might have held against him, he was in a position to extend grace, and he did, didn't he? "Don't be afraid," he said. "Just believe." And he did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And when they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. See, Jesus, he was on his way to see Jairus in the first place, remember? So he hadn't refused him. And he shows up at his home, and there's this grieving going on because the daughter has died. There's all this commotion and wailing going on, and he says, Jesus has a way of saying things that don't make sense. There's all this wailing. What happens when you lay the child down for a nap and the older brothers and sisters are wailing and carrying on? You get after them because they're going to wake the baby, right? Well, Jesus says to them, and all this commotion, he says, "The child is not dead but asleep," and they all laughed at him. There, I guess, would be a natural response. They all laughed at him. So he put them all out, took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him, Peter, James, and John, and went into where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." And immediately the child stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old. And at this they were completely astonished. Jesus said to him, "Don't be afraid, just believe." And so here's mother and father, Jesus and these three closest disciples, and he simply takes her by the hand and says, "Child, get up." Marvelous little example of grace extended here. And we still read about it thousands of years later. And we need to take heart and be encouraged by these examples, because Jesus is indeed an extender of grace, and we can be thankful for that. So at this, they were completely astonished. Are you completely astonished? Have you ever had occasion to be completely astonished because God extended grace to you, a miserable sinner? Have you ever been in that situation where you just were so utterly embarrassed by what you had done or said or whatever? Just bungled the works up really badly. And to be utterly astonished at the grace extended to you? It's one thing when God extends grace to you. It's another thing, isn't it, when the offended individual extends grace to you. You just expect to be, you know, cursed or shunned for the rest of the age. But that individual extends grace. You know, oftentimes the grace of God gets extended to us through the actions of another human being. Isn't it Christ in us, the hope of glory? Isn't that what we're trying to do? Manifest the life of Jesus Christ in our day-to-day lives. So you can expect on occasion that when you need grace, God will send another human being to extend it. Jesus isn't here now. I can't call him up and say, well, I can, but I mean, you know, physically he's not going to walk in the door probably. I mean, if he does, fine, but I'm not expecting it, right? And so there are times you might be sent as the bearer of grace from God himself. Think about it. You know, we talk about forgiveness, we talk about situations where, you know, we need to be the example, to follow Christ's example, to do as he does. And so, you know, nobody is worthy. I mean, Jesus is the only one that doesn't need grace per se. But there'll be those occasions when God will send you to take his grace as a gift to someone else, and or someone is sent to you to extend grace. And most of the time, let's admit it, folks, most of the time when we see an act of genuine grace extended, we are completely astonished. Why should that be? Well, I have a feeling we're just not used to being as gracious as we might should be. And so we need to call upon God in our weakness, in our shortcomings, to possess the grace of God. Why do you have the fruits of the Spirit? You ever ask yourself that? I'm sure you have. Why does a tree have apples? An apple tree bear apples. So does the tree eat the apples? No, someone else eats the apples. Why do you have the fruits of God's Spirit? So someone else will benefit. Think of it. You don't have the fruits of God's Spirit so you can go around bragging about how wonderfully God has made you fruitful. You have the fruits of God's Spirit manifest in you so that you can be the bearer of grace to other individuals, so that you can be the example of Jesus Christ. What a great world it'll be someday when we're all able and yield ourselves to God in such a way as we can take the grace of God, and nobody will be astonished. I'm looking forward to that time. I'm looking forward to the time when all the downtrodden will be given grace and know it. It's a great thing. We look forward to the coming of Jesus Christ and the establishment of his kingdom, and that's why. It's so that the grace of God is extended to all, and the forgiveness of sin is extended to all, and we all walk in the mind and the heart and the spirit of Jesus Christ. It's a wonderful thing. Give thanks to God for the grace that comes through Jesus Christ.